Welcome to the 10K Collective, my friends. Now, look, if you're listening for hacks and short-term tactics, I'm afraid you are in the wrong place. Let me tell you about the 10K Collective Mastermind. First of all, its members meet in person. They know each other well. They all make over $500,000 a year. Several make several million a year. Many have doubled their revenue over the last 18 months. If you're that kind of person, then this podcast is made for you. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com. Ladies and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. The boys and girls are listening, by the way, probably not for you because this is for 6, 7, and 8 figure Amazon sellers. Although I do have a 17-year-old who was an Amazon seller once at a pretty significant level. But we are talking about freight with Brian Miller of Easy China Warehouse, and he's over in Shenzhen in China, originally from Connecticut in the USA. So got a really great handle on what's going on over there. So Brian, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we talked in the last episode about the whole sort of current situation or recent situation. So we're recording this in May 2020, and we talked through the whole coronavirus thing. I'd love to talk about more evergreen content today, more best practices for China freight, which obviously is going to change a bit depending on the situation. But there are some things that I think are principles that we can follow in most situations. So the first thing is something that you offer, which is storing stuff in China. And that's becoming increasingly common as people realize that storing things in third-party warehouses in the US is not only more expensive, but actually, of course, right now in May 2020, there's the capacity is very constrained there and it can be very expensive, therefore just impossible to get. So what are the best practices for storing things in China itself? And the reasons why as well, I should say.
Yeah, we're kind of seeing like a trend of people being more interested in this type of model. So everyone always thinks, okay, once I make my stuff in China, I got to get it out of there. But that's not really the case now. You can actually leave your product at a warehouse in China. And there's a lot of benefits to doing that. The first is cost. So instead of having your product at a prep warehouse, let's say in US or Europe, where you have to pay US and European prices for the, you know, space and the labor and all that stuff, you can have warehouse services in China for much lower cost. So that's the first thing. The second thing is for people that are starting to sell in many different marketplaces, which a lot of the larger sellers to do, whether it be, you know, North America, Japan, and Europe, we see a lot of people selling in. If you commit to one country, like sending your whole container to the US, and then you need a product in, let's say, Germany or Japan, you end up double shipping your product. So you ship it to the US and then you ship it to Japan. And that's obviously much more expensive than just leaving it in China and shipping a portion of it to the US. And then when you need inventory in Japan, shipping that portion directly to Japan, especially because Japan's so close to China. And also you can think about, at least for our case, we're very close to Hong Kong, and Hong Kong is a global shipping center for both sea and air freight. So being in that position in the world, you get very, very competitive rates going anywhere in the world from that place. And so maybe if you do ship it to some random warehouse in the middle of the US or Europe, it might not be so easy to actually get it out of there and go to another country. So it generally is less flexible for sellers. So those are kind of a lot of the benefits that we see for people leaving their stuff in China.
And I think you made an important point, first of all, just to pick up on that last point. There's a few famous inspection warehouses, which all of us have used, which are in the middle of nowhere, basically. I mean, you know, so LAX is the biggest, you know, freight importing port in the world, I guess, well, certainly in the US. And sure, being near that is good. But if you're up in the California hills in the middle of nowhere, that's probably not helpful. So you make an important point about the physical location of the warehouse, as well as obviously labor is cheaper in China. And I guess that the logic for manufacturing there has to extend to the logic for doing other stuff there as well. And if at some point it becomes more expensive to import from China because of the import taxes and stuff, is not going to be improved by doing your labor in an expensive area, right? Plus, space is at a premium in Europe generally, and in the UK, it's pretty densely packed population. So it's really not a smart place to rent space, in my opinion, unless you really have to. But I guess the other fear and the reason why people store stuff in the country where they're going to sell it is the reliability and the speed of the supply chain. So talk me through that one, particularly in sort of crisis times. I mean, how reliable can it be, and is it fast enough? Do you find that your seller companies find it fast and reliable enough to lean on that?
So that is a good point. Like that might be a slight disadvantage, which is we're a bit farther, obviously, from an Amazon warehouse in the US if it's in China, right? And so, you know, it's a little bit harder to plan, but we have very stable sea shipping times of like 20 to 25 days. And so the people, they can be a little bit uncomfortable starting to do it. But after some time, once they get used to their kind of general sales velocity, we ask them to add maybe 20% more in general to each order just to compensate for a possible increase in sales. That is typically very stable for our sea freight and for our rail. So we, and by rail, I mean rail to Europe. So we ship a lot of product by rail because it's a very stable shipping method in time. And so a lot of sellers choose our US sea freight and our European rail. So we typically find that people are quite happy once they figure out how to manage their own inventory for the extended times to ship into Amazon.
Interesting. So I suppose also that you're going to need to order products. So the lead time manufacturing plus shipping into Amazon, the total time is really the main thing that we have to be aware of anyway, right? So I suppose the local warehousing would only account for sales spikes. And if you're good at predicting or your demand is fairly steady, then I guess that becomes less necessary. Tell me about rail, by the way. There's something I heard opening a few years ago. I remember reading and thinking, oh, that's interesting. I wonder if anyone actually uses it. And I've not really heard anyone mention sort of using it in anger. How does that work? And how do the costs and times compare to sea?
So it's a little bit more expensive than sea, but the times are a bit quicker. Usually we can get them to Europe within about 30 days. And we see it a little bit longer for sea freight generally. And also sea freight, there's a lot of variables that it's a less stable shipment method. So in general, we recommend our customers, even though it's a little bit more expensive, that they use the European rail. And that usually leaves from Yiwu, China, YIWU, we load the container in Shenzhen, and then we send it up to Yiwu, where it's shipped through China, through Russia, and into Europe.
So what is it that makes the sea freight going into Europe from China less stable than the rail then? It sounds like it's less of a stable route than from China to the US, for example. What are the factors behind that?
You're getting out my geography here now. But generally, we see just like a longer shipping time generally to Europe, and whether it's delays on the China side or delays getting the product into European cities in Europe. And in general, it takes a little longer for the boat to get there. And there's like just more chance that there could be a delay just in the way that it goes. Whereas in the US, we ship like China direct to LA port. It's direct through the Pacific. It's a pretty straight route. And it's relatively stable when we look at the sea shipment when you compare it to Europe. So I don't know if that's a great answer, but
no, it's good enough. We don't need to be in them. This isn't a geography quiz, but I mean, I guess thinking about it, if I'm just visualizing the globe and where it would go. I mean, the routes to Europe, obviously, there's this thing in the way called Asia, right, which would kind of get in the way. Whereas I guess theoretically, you just kind of ship steam across from Shenzhen direct to LA and yep, across the Pacific. There's nothing in the way. You don't have to go around, you know, Cape Horn or anything. So it makes sense. But I just wanted to check that I wasn't missing something. But that's interesting. So rail to Europe, I mean, what sort of costs are we talking about then? So the speed is a bit quicker. Let's just put some numbers on it. Roughly how quickly does it go via rail versus sea, and roughly what are the cost differences as well?
We're like, I mean, for us, we're about 30 plus days by rail to Europe, to an Amazon warehouse. And then for sea, 40 plus days. So it could be 1 to 2 weeks longer that we see. And that means delivery to the Amazon warehouse, obviously. So it's quicker and it's only slightly more expensive. I don't know. I don't want to have you quote me on the percentage price difference in cost, but I think it's maybe between 10%+ more to ship by rail from the last time I've looked at some of the price schedules.
Interesting. Well, it gives us a ballpark figure. I mean, that's interesting to know. So it's not like the difference between air freight and sea freight. And what's interesting also is that if you're talking about 30 days via rail and these days maybe 2 weeks via air, then again, rail is maybe the alternative for people in a hurry getting stuff to Europe, right? Which is very interesting.
Yeah, most of our sellers that have been doing air traditionally through us, like a lot of air freight. We've all recommended them during the coronavirus to just ship by rail. And a lot of them have really liked it. And they've actually moved all of their shipping to rail. So I guess it's worse for us for profit. We make less money, but it's definitely better for our customers. And we always say, like, if our customers can make more money, then they'll be longer term better customers in general. So we're like happy to provide better solutions like that to them.
And well, something that's more sustainable all around, it means that the lifetime customer value is higher, right? So it's a win all around. I really like it. I mean, what I love about it is it's very old school. I mean, I guess that is it the Trans-Siberian Railway? Is that what it goes on? Because that was built in like the 1890s or something, right?
Yeah. And I think it also has to do with China's Belt and Road policy, where they kind of want to connect the globe with their rail network. Mm-hmm. Funny enough, I actually used to work for the Chinese company that the state-owned company that did railroad in China. So that was actually my previous experience. And so I got a good taste of like what China is doing to, let's say, promote the railroad technology. And I think this is part of like connecting them to the rest of the world, but also trying to sell their railroad products and technology to other countries. So I think it's both in that type of thing.
And I think when you work on giant platforms like the US government's ideas about import tax, that's part of what we can't avoid. China, that is a big thing we can't avoid. And Amazon, and if you're selling on Amazon, or even if you're not and you think your platform independent, I've got news for you. Google is owned by a private company, and so is Facebook, and so is YouTube. There is no way that we can reach the rest of the world and sell stuff without being dependent on large entities. So what I'm saying, the reason I'm saying this is if you align yourself with the direction of travel of policy of those large entities, so whether it be Amazon or China in this case, then you're going to be going with the flow, right? Because China's got a huge push into Europe with its Belt and Road policy, and there's less resistance there than there seems to be politically in the US. Now, there can be changes and backlashes and what have you. One of the reasons that I understand that the coronavirus spread from Wuhan to northern Italy so quickly, for example, is because there are a ton of connections, a lot of Chinese workers and a lot of flights in and out of northern Italy with the massive fashion-driven clothing industry there around Milan. So that's one of the reasons that it worked. But that's also part of, I think, the Belt and Road policy. There's a very big connection with Italy, for example. So I think it's good to align your business practices with the bigger picture because it's going to go more easily. I mean, yes, we've got to deal with the Chinese government and the US government seem to be, you know, wrestling with each other, and that may be predictably going ahead in the future as well. But China to Europe and the Belt and Road thing seem to go together. So interesting sort of bigger picture, of which the freight is a smaller picture, I think. Because if you start trying to fight the big guys, you're in trouble, I think. So that's interesting anyway. So without going down a rabbit hole there, tell me a little bit about the things we should look out for then when we're trying to do this thing. Obviously, there are some things that can happen that aren't so desirable when you have a more complex or more extended or more distant, physically distant supply chain. So what are the sort of checkpoints that we should have when we're trying to do this consolidate in China and store in China and then send over to our marketplaces type model?
I think we have to keep like a really good look on our sales velocity more strictly, let's say daily and weekly. Maybe if you store your product in a local warehouse, you might not really focus on like how many products you have every day in Amazon and like what that number is, because you're always a few days away from Amazon, right? So looking at your past, you can go into Seller Central and look at your past sales velocity and how well you're doing this year, and really making like clear projections on what you're going to sell this year. And that's going to help with your shipping. It's also going to help with your business, right? So you're going to be able to plan more accordingly for your business. But I think also one of the benefits of this model, which is like shipping from China, is you can order smaller lots of product and ship it to us and not have to put up so much cash for inventory all the time. So we have people dripping product in from China very slowly and or weekly if they want. And never before did people think it was an option, because the cost effectiveness of the LCL really can be competitive to what you used to ship, because you always thought, oh, I need to bring in a full container all the time. So you have to put up X amount of cash to bring in a ton of product that you sell over 6 months. And so our model also allows customers not only to be more focused on their planning, but also order in smaller amounts and hold more cash in their pocket, which we know people like. And one thing I also forgot to mention is that you can also, when you order those small amounts, you have a better chance to reject product that is faulty in China because it hasn't left. So you could actually send it back to the factory and say, this is a bad product. It's very hard to do that when you get it into the US. How do you deal with it, right? And so that's a benefit of ordering smaller amounts and also having it there in China that hasn't left the country.
By the way, those are huge things. I mean, those are not sort of slight tweaks. I think the cash flow thing, for example, instead of ordering 6 months worth of inventory, which means you've got a much bigger upfront cost, and then waiting 6 months to get that money back, if you put, say, 3 months worth of inventory money upfront and you sell it in 3 months as well, that's just massively changed the working capital needed for, isn't it? Because I mean, working capital is basically a function of, you know, how long you hang on to your stock. So I think that's huge. I mean, I think the cash flow characteristic, having more cash in the pocket is not only more reassuring, of course, everyone likes it, but I think it changes the characteristics of the business model you're running. So I really think that's a profound change, actually, as long as it can be done reliably.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a small thing at all. I think people underestimate that. I think what happens, even with some reasonably sophisticated sellers, obviously the really sophisticated ones have got their, you know, financial director or, you know, chief financial officer will be very aware of this stuff. But most of us don't think enough about cash flow. I think we get obsessed with sales, of course, and if we've grown up, profit. But the cash flow thing is really the limitation on growth, or the thing that kills the business if you get it wrong, you know. So that's huge. And the quality control thing, so if you're ordering small amounts and you can reject in China and send it back in China, that makes a lot of sense. I presume that means that you guys do inspection as well at your warehouse.
Yeah, we can, according to the customer's requirements. So they would send us like a sheet, hey, we want this and this checked, and we want X number of units checked out of the whole lot. We would do that. A lot of customers actually don't have us do that, but if they required it, we could do that at our facility. And also, we can make any changes to the product. So if we did realize there was a problem, let's say the factory put the Amazon label on incorrectly, or they put the wrong label on, or whatever it might be, right? Like at that time, we can make a modification in our warehouse before it leaves to go to Amazon. And when you put a wrong label on Amazon's product, we all know it gets thrown in like some dungeon for 2 months and you can't find it. So it helps people avoid these type of really, you know, catastrophic situations that happen when Amazon gets something and you can't figure out what's happening to the product, you know?
Absolutely. And I think it's a similar argument to getting a pre-shipment inspection just outside your China warehouse, I guess, really. But I think having somewhere else in the supply chain where you can, you know, break it up and double check that, as you say, before that horrible thing when you ship to Amazon without the right labels and it's chucked somewhere, anything that can prevent or minimize that has got to be hugely worthwhile, for sure. It's so painful when it goes wrong with Amazon. It really goes wrong, right? Can't get hold of anyone, takes weeks to sort out. So tell me a bit about the staying in stock thing, because that's always top of mind for serious sellers. We talked about the shipping times in the previous episode, and any other sort of best practices to stay in stock. I'm obviously keeping an eye on stock levels and in sort of sales velocity is another one thing, but any other sort of ideas that you've seen with your best clients of staying in stock?
They're always ordering a little bit more than they need, of course. And they also order, we find that they order very, very frequently. So they're always keeping a production run in line, even if they have like one reserve batch. It usually takes us a month to get the product to Amazon, right? So they have about a month of reserves ready to go at any time before they release another order. So with us, since we're so close and we can move the product so quickly, we're seeing people put 1 month of safety stock and then keep orders coming monthly depending on sales velocity. So that's what we see generally, like smaller orders more often and with 1 month of safety stock.
Great. And the other thing I want to dig into then, since it's obviously such a big part of what you offer, is to understand a little bit more in detail what's going on in supply chain with less than container load or LCL type shipping. So what's the standard sort of way of that gets done? So can you walk me through the sort of where, you know, your goods are made in the factory, what happens to them next? Just physically walk me through that.
Most often, like with traditional freight forwarding, if your product is made, you do FOB terms. So your product is made by the factory, and then the factory is required to bring that product to the port and export it out of Chinese customs. And then at the port, your freight forwarder will take your product along with others that are at the port warehouse and basically put them together into one container. And that process could take some time, right? So they don't always put you together very quickly. And that's where we see a lot of delays on the China side in freight forwarding when that forwarder is trying to put you with other people. And also the margin that the freight forwarder makes from that is quite high. So that's kind of the traditional method. And then they put you in a container. They bring you over to the US or Europe, and then they clear you through customs, and then they bring you to another warehouse where they deconsolidate the container. So they take all of the seller's products out of that container, and then you from that warehouse ship your product to another location, whether it be Amazon or another warehouse. So you have kind of a lot of steps in that method to get your stuff from China and to your final destination in the US.
So there's a lot of steps there. So tell me a bit more about your approach with Easy China Warehouse. What steps do you sort of eliminate or tweak in that way?
So what we do is we load the container before it gets to the port. So we take all of the product at our warehouse and put it in a container, a full container, so that when we bring the container to the port, it's already full and it's ready to load onto the ship immediately. So we bring it to the port a few days before the container is actually loaded, and it gets right on the boat immediately, whereas we don't have any waiting time at the port, right? And then once we bring it to the US, we also take the whole container, bring it to a warehouse, but we don't have to separate it or think much about it, because in China, we've labeled it already with UPS labels that ship to the end location of wherever you want it. So we literally take the product out of the container and pass it right on to UPS or FedEx, where they make final delivery. So that's a bit quicker to deconsolidate, and it moves to your FBA warehouse faster than having to take it out and then arrange a shipment method to an FBA warehouse.
I like it. And the fundamental thing you've done, I guess, is that you've done the work in advance. So you've consolidated everything in advance, not at the port, and then you've deconsolidated what you've put the labels on. So the deconsolidation method is, I guess, what do you literally do? You just take the pallets off and then ship each pallet off to wherever it needs to. You hand it over to UPS because it's already labeled up. I guess it gets straight into their system and off to the Amazon warehouse, right?
Correct. Yeah. So all the like hard work of like sorting through all the freight is done in China.
Yeah.
So we sort it and we label it and we put it all together so that when the people in the US take it apart, they don't have to think. All the labels are there. All the correct addresses to those final destinations are on those cartons already. And so they don't need to like separate it or think about anything. They just literally need to take it out and give it to UPS. So that's what saves a lot of cost, specifically in the US as well.
It's very elegant. I mean, I was talking to my new co-host in a sort of strategy podcast called The E-Commerce Leader, Jason Miles, about this and why process, although it's not a sexy thing, and like, you know, freight surely is one of those things that you just have to get right, but isn't seen as sexy. But what I love about that is you've really, from a 60,000 foot view, just set down on paper, if you like, the processes that go into freight and then just made them more elegant. And the lovely thing about that is you spend less of your money on freight and it gets there quicker. I mean, what's not to like? So I really like the elegance of that structure. It's great. So a couple of other topics then. First of all, China and internal freight. I'm just kind of going through the chain and thinking, where are their breaks? Where are the sort of limitations? So getting from your factory to the port is obviously an important part of the process. And if your factory happens to be a long way from the port, that could be quite significant. So tell me about how that's working at the moment. I know that there was some trucking limitations in China. Is that still the case in May 2020?
It's not now. Like, logistics is running very efficiently in China. We see the costs are relatively stable and comparable to what they were before the virus. So we see that as a good positive, and it's easy to get stuff around, easy to get stuff picked up. For us in our model, obviously, we need to load the container in the south of China. So if people have factories in the Shanghai area, we always help people pick up their product wherever it is in China and bring it to our facility where we load the container. So we do that very often, and we haven't seen any issues at all currently with domestic freight within China.
That's good to know. I mean, I never like to assume that, but I mean, it does sound like China's back to business, and that's reassuring, because that certainly wasn't the case a few weeks ago. And we'll see how evergreen this statement is when we, in a few weeks time, we'll put it out there. So tell me another thing then, you work with third-party fulfillment. So obviously one of the things that has been thrust upon people is the limitations of the FBA warehouse system, so fulfilled by Amazon, and the word limitation and Amazon don't normally go together in my mind anyway, but obviously even the mighty Amazon warehouse system couldn't quite cope with the demand spike recently, although I think that's easing week by week. But what it has made people realize is that they're vulnerable to that one point of failure, and a lot of people are doing third-party fulfillment, fulfilled by merchant stuff. So how do you guys work with that sort of system?
So we actually do direct from China fulfillment to the end customer anywhere in the world. Now, a lot of FBA sellers don't choose it because it's not really a viable option for FBM, just because it takes too long. Typically, we can ship between 1 and 2 weeks to the US from China to the end customer, quite reasonably priced. But still, for the Amazon buyer that's very used to 2-day prime delivery, it's kind of not really satisfactory. But what people can think about is that, you know, during a time like this where you might be running out of product and you need to ship some things to your end customer, or if you do have kind of a random market that's quite hot for your product that you don't want to fulfill through Amazon, let's say Canada, which is quite a small country in terms of population, but you do have orders there, we could ship them directly from China if you wanted. And we have some sellers that ship that sell quite well in the US that have a small demand in Australia and don't want to store their product in FBA in Australia just because their demand isn't high enough. And we help them do a little bit of FBM from directly from China to Australia. So there are some like edge cases where some sellers might see some value for it, but we don't see it as like a primary channel for FBA sellers.
No, that's clearly, the delay is a bit too much. But when you're working with, say, a third-party fulfillment, so 3PL is the other word that knocks around, all these abbreviations, say you've got a warehouse in or a fulfillment system in the West Coast of the US, for example, and you know, you want to work with them, how do you guys sort of interact with a warehouse like that?
For our customers, or our customers want to take their product to one of those places, like an outside fulfillment center?
An outside fulfillment center. So I'm assuming that, you know, let's say you've got an FBM warehouse based in somewhere on the West Coast of the States, because that's often a favorite place to be because of where the stuff ships in from. And they have a fulfillment network in the US, and our sellers want to ship into them from China. How do you sort of connect the dots there?
So that's kind of the beauty about our model as well, which is where we basically label everything before we load the container. So if a customer has, let's say, 1,000 units and they want half of those to go to FBA and half of them to go to their third-party warehouse, in China, before we load the container, we'll actually label them with the appropriate UPS labels so that they're ready directly to leave that container and go to the correct location. So not only can we ship to FBA warehouses, but we can also ship to a third-party fulfillment center that's not Amazon and split your freight up around the US in 200 kilogram increments. So if you had like, if you had 1,000 kilograms, I could help you ship it to 5 different places around the US. So that also adds a lot of flexibility for people that have many different places to ship to in the US that are scattered. And we can do that as well.
That sounds really helpful. I mean, I think that is one of the sort of bits where it can get very granular with Amazon FBA warehouses. Sometimes if you have got to ship to like 10 different warehouses and they're wanting like 3 cartons here, 1 carton here, that's also a bit of a nightmare. So I think the ability to split it up further, that's also maybe an argument for using 3PL warehouses to a degree to rationalize that kind of ridiculous level of, you know, send 3 units here and 15 here. I mean, it's amazing when you look at your inventory report, isn't it? Just how many warehouses, even if you've got a relatively modest number of units out there, how many different warehouses in the US they're spread across.
Right.
And of course, I've discovered that personally because I've ended up, you know, when, as you say, the dreaded, they've thrown it into a dark corner because it was mislabeled thing. And you suddenly, you know, dig into the detail and realize that it's spread all over the US, like 3 units here, 10 units there. So yeah, it's good to have a way to deal with that. Well, look, I think we've covered a hell of a lot of stuff here. Have you got any things that you think we should know about when it comes to fulfillment from China directly, or more importantly, probably working with third-party warehouses, that fulfillment by a merchant?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know from my own experience, it's good to, specifically in the US, I've had a bad experience with a third-party fulfillment warehouse. So, and once your product gets stuck in that warehouse, it's hard to get it out, right? So even if you were to work with us, we always recommend to send a small amount in the beginning to get a feel for the third-party logistic company that you're working with. do a trial order or two, see how it goes, and then from there decide to put more and more products. So always do a trial, always keep it small in the beginning, get a feel, try a few orders, and then from there you can expound if you're happy with the service. And we even recommend that for us. Don't go full throttle with us. Go slow if you ever choose us, and see how we do, and then go from there.
Very good common sense advice. I think it probably applies to just about everything in business. If it's new, then test it first, which sounds obvious, but a lot of us, you know, plunge in feet first sometimes with new things. So yeah, that's very, very good advice. And particularly with freight forwarders, I think, and I'm glad you were honest and said that, because I think, like, you can't physically inspect a freight supply chain that stretches from China to US or Europe, right? So you have to rely on what people say. And the only truth of the, you know, the testing of that is going to be in the eating, as they say. The proof of the pudding's in the eating, as we say in Britain. I have no idea if Americans say that. So just recap for us what you can do for people in that regard and how people can get hold of you.
Yeah, the best way to get a hold of us is to go to our website at easychinawarehouse.com, or you can email us at brian@easychinawarehouse.com. So that's two ways you can kind of get in touch with us.
That's great. And any last minute sort of general tips on freight out of China into the US, or for that matter, Europe, that we've missed?
I think the only thing that people need, I mean, this may be not evergreen, but as the coronavirus progresses and we see second waves possibly occurring, I think people should think about, you know, where those might happen and how it might affect the speed of delivery. So, you know, if there's a second wave in the US, it's probably going to affect the speed of domestic delivery within the US, and the same goes with China. So I think in the future, at least for the next year or two, as the virus keeps going around, we should, you know, consider this.
And that's wise to sort of track where it's going to become a problem in the supply chain or the demand side. Or it's a fun game we're engaged in at the moment, but that sounds like one to revisit in a few months, maybe, to come back and see how things are progressing. But for now, Brian, lots of common sense, and I really like the system you've got, and I really like the honesty about, like, you know, try before you buy in bulk. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing all your insights there.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to the 10K Collective podcast, part of the family of amazing FBA podcasts. Today's episode is sponsored by the new e-commerce podcast, The E-Commerce Leader. The podcast is hosted by yours truly and Jason Miles, multi-million dollar Shopify owner and Udemy's highest rated e-commerce instructor. If you're the owner of a thriving online business and you want to become the best e-commerce leader you can be, it's got your name on it. For free guides and mini courses on many topics, go to www.theecommerceleader.com.